Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. A serious program today, at least in great part, as we remember 9/11 and the dogs of 9/11, the search and rescue dogs. The most iconic dog because of an image that was taken of this dog, a golden retriever, in a Stokes basket. That's kind of like a stretcher of sorts, as the dog was lifted from one side of Ground Zero to the other side of Ground Zero. It was the only way they could efficiently get the dog from one place to another, rather than traversing those, if you recall, like giant mountains that were there at the time. This was the safest way and the best way to do it. And someone snapped a picture, and that picture still stands up today. You see that picture all the time. We'll talk with the owner of that dog. It's that time now where the kids are back in school. You may be going back to the office. No one let the pets know this is going to happen. There's going to be another change. We've talked a lot about that on the show, and there are things you can do perhaps preemptively. There are things you can do if you notice subtle, and they often are, subtle signs of anxiety in our pets. You know, we think about this happening, Dr. Packel, and people often think full-blown separation anxiety, and while that can happen, there's this huge area that I think is in between where the pets just aren't happy about you being gone or take a while to adjust to the new normal and you can help them adjust to it. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right, Steve. You know, and I think one of the things that we, you know, we really recognized in the midst of all of this, you know, pandemic transition that we've all been experiencing over the last year and a half or so is that, you know, while some of those pets who experience separation anxiety, as you mentioned, really have been living their best lives for the last year and a half with their family there 24/7, some pets actually struggled having that much contact time with their family. And then there's that other population that it really wasn't inherently a positive or a negative change. It was just different. And so they've struggled to adapt to the change in the routine. And so as we think forward, as we think about back to school or returning to the workplace, that whatever time that happens for you in your lifestyle, we really want to think about those changes. What is going to be different for your animal and their perception of the world, whether that's more contact time or less, or again, even just a difference in their routine that they don't necessarily have the capacity to understand right off the bat. And we may need to provide some additional support for them.
You know, sometimes with dogs, and I would argue even more so with cats, it's difficult to tell that they're anxious in the first place. How can people tell?
I really look for anything that's different from normal. And I've learned to do that over the years because when I tell someone to look for a specific sign, like panting, for example, in a dog, sure, that's a sign of stress for some dogs, but not all stressed dogs pant. And dogs may pant for reasons other than stress. So yes, it's important to know some of the common signs like pacing, panting, whining, drooling, vocalizing, attention seeking, hiding. All of those things can be signs of stress, but I really try to help my owners understand, you know your dog or cat really better than anyone does. Are you seeing significant changes within their demeanor, their appetite, their energy level, potentially even in their urine or stool production, something that you say, whoa, wait a minute, this is different from usual. Can I ask myself that additional question of whether we think this may be something that's happening secondary to a stress response? And that's when we really open the door to some of the intervention options that are available to us.
Oh, that leads me perfectly to this question. I mean, there are all kinds of products now that are available, everything from pheromone products to Purina has a nutritional supplement that actually it's a probiotic, right? And what it does is it lowers anxiety in dogs. And there are all these nutraceuticals out there. So how do you know what's right for your pet?
Yeah, it's a great question. And quite honestly, it can be pretty darn overwhelming. And, you know, at a high level, I often tell my clients, you know, gosh, almost everything can work for some animals. And I say that because sometimes it does take a bit of trial and observation to really see what's going to work for your animal, because that anxiety response or that fear response may be something that's relatively universal, but your animal has a unique makeup. Their physiology is unique to them. And so there are a lot of different inroads that may allow us to impact that fear and anxiety response, whether that's through changing the gut microflora in a way that you mentioned with probiotic therapy, or whether it's using some of the veterinary approved supplements that have some scientific rigor to them that allow us to say, yeah, I think I've got a good sense of confidence that this is something that may work for my pet.
Do you have confidence in any of the specific products out there yourself?
I do. You know, I look for a couple of different things. I tend to gravitate more towards the products that are distributed through the veterinary market, because I know that those companies have put the extra time and energy and effort and expense even into making sure that they're putting out a reliable product that goes through appropriate production, and there's a level of, well, confidence in that product. One of the ones that I use commonly in my practice, both for cats and for dogs, is a product called Zilkeen. It's made by Vetiquinol, and it's a hydrolyzed milk protein that comes in a little blue capsule. The advantage here for this particular product, in my eyes, is not only that it can work for a lot of our animals, but that it can work both situationally as well as long-term, and it's often very, very palatable, even for cats who can, well, truthfully, can be a little bit difficult to take their medications or their supplements when we want them to.
Or just finicky. By the way, the name of the Purina product is called Calming Care that I was referring to, available for dogs, available for cats. In addition to that, are there some other things that people can do, like leaving out food puzzles so the pet is distracted and has something? I call it occupational therapy for pets. The pet, the dog or cat, has something else to do all those hours that you're gone. Is that a good idea?
It certainly is. You know, assuming that there aren't any safety concerns with leaving a long-lasting food item, obviously we want to make sure that we're utilizing appropriate toys for their size and their chewing strength and all of those sorts of things. But yes, absolutely. And whether that functions to really just sort of take their mind off the fact that they're alone, or sort of giving them something to do to keep them busy throughout the day, or whether we're actually laying the foundation for actually starting to condition a new emotional response to help teach that animal that good things are happening when they're home alone. And by making that experience happen consistently for them, we can actually develop a greater sense of resilience and stress tolerance for those times when they do actually need to be left alone. So there's a lot of ways that that can work in a very positive direction for us and our pets.
Now let's take it a step further, and let's say that you believe that your dog has, or cat, has separation anxiety. To me, it's one of those things that a veterinarian, I mean, you wouldn't say, oh, my dog has heart disease, now I'm going to take action. This is something, I believe, separation anxiety that a veterinarian actually needs to diagnose, and you could help by setting it up, you know, with one of those cameras simply. But they're pretty inexpensive now. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think, you know, when we're really thinking about making a diagnosis, that is something that needs to occur by a medical professional. And, you know, especially for something with separation anxiety, it's important to remember that emotional experiences are not the only things that can change the visible behavior patterns. So part of that veterinary involvement is not only fact-checking to make sure that, yes, in fact, separation anxiety is what we are dealing with, but also that we're not seeing some other underlying physical issue, whether that's a hormonal imbalance, whether that's a new expression of a pain response, or something else that requires that medical evaluation to really tease out. So absolutely, the veterinary team needs to be involved right from the get-go.
Or maybe the dog is barking. Yes, but the dog is barking because somebody's walking by. And you may be able to better understand that the dog's actually having a good time, rather, because it's self-reinforcing, rather than truly being anxious. As another example, Dr. Chris Pockel, always, always informative to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
About to have the 20th anniversary of 9/11, meaning the terrorist attack in New York City and Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C., something I hope our country, of course, never experiences again. And at Ground Zero, pretty quickly, there were these dogs that appeared, the search and rescue dogs and the cadaver dogs, who made an enormous difference. And I think people remember those dogs. The most memorable dog, arguably, is that photograph of the dog in the Stokes basket. That's a basket that carried a dog over the rubble from one place to another. That dog's name was Riley. And Chris Selfridge, who had that dog, is here. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thank you. So you had a search and rescue dog. 9/11 happens. Did you know that you'd be called in?
We had a feeling, you know, that as things transpired, that at some point, you know, there may be a need for urban search and rescue teams across the country somewhere. When the first two planes hit, we didn't know how many more they had. So at that point, we kind of had a feeling we were going to be going to work somewhere.
And it turned out you went to work fairly close to Pennsylvania's New York City, and you went to work there. What does that mean? You arrive on the scene. What was it like? Let's start with this. Dogs have a sense of smell up to 10,000 times more than we do. What did you even smell? Because I'm told by other search and rescue dog handlers that that was the first thing they noticed, even within several blocks of Ground Zero.
Well, the first day or two, as you think back, the smells were the fires and the smoke and all the debris burning. And it wasn't like a wood fire, you know. It was acrid smoke. It was nasty, crappy, yuck.
Yeah.
That is a good enough way to describe it. As time went on, the smells throughout the area kind of changed, you know, but I don't recall it being like an overwhelming odor of just imminent death everywhere, if that's what you're looking for.
No, I'm not looking for anything necessarily. How is your health as a result of you being right there for days at a time? And did your dog, Riley, do you think, suffer as a result of any of that?
My health's doing okay. We're kind of monitored by a World Trade Center health program. So they provide us with physicals and everything on a regular basis to keep track with us and keep us up to date. Riley, he had a couple skin issues that were starting to show up afterwards. Nothing that got really bad, but, you know, who's to say where they came from? We just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he would just get hot spots and things where he never had issues before. So who knows?
Was that the hardest mission, the most difficult mission, physically, do you think, or emotionally, for your dog? And dogs do have emotions, so I'm asking that question.
That was probably Riley's second or third FEMA deployment. He had gone on a couple hurricane responses prior to that. But that was the biggest incident, you know, short of Pearl Harbor in World War II that anybody dealt with. You know, it
sure.
was physically demanding. It was emotionally demanding for everybody, including the dogs.
And the photograph, that photograph of Riley in the Stokes basket that I could still see in my head, was so associated after 9/11 with the events of 9/11. How did that picture come about?
Excuse me. I honestly, Steve, did not know the photograph was taken for a couple months after. We were just doing our job. Riley was on his way being transported back to the West Street area after we had worked all afternoon on the remains of the North Tower. And a journalist from the United States Navy, Preston Kears, took the photograph, and he contacted me and said, "I think I have a picture of your dog, and we'd just like to figure out who it is."
Mm-hmm.
So kind of came from there.
And now that photograph is the most arguably renowned, or at least one of the most renowned photographs of the events of 9/11, something I suppose you never would have predicted. But isn't it nice that so many people can see Riley all the time, unfortunately associated with one of the most horrible events in American history, but still that your dog and you were a part of that.
It's humbling, you know. There were over 300 dogs there, all doing a great job. Just so happens that, I guess you could say photograph-wise, he was in the right place at the right time.
But I suppose even more important was providing closure for some families. And though your dog is trained to find live people, many of the dogs trained to find live people can do more than that and are, if you will, untrained, but very adept at being a cadaver dog. Your dog was one of those dogs?
He ended up kind of informally being, I won't even say trained. He informally started figuring out that, hey, there's something else here. And just in odd ways would, he would act different or paw at the ground or whatever. And then we would just look in that area, and sometimes we would find what we were looking for, and other times, you know, it was a situation where we would just tell the fireman, keep looking. You know, I think there may be something here.
Well, the dogs are hardly ever wrong, so I assume there was something there, which helped families, you know, so.
And if I can add,
sure.
One of the other huge parts the dogs did was the emotional support. All the dogs, as they were going across the pile to on lead or however to get to a site they were to work, the fireman would stop and pet them. And you'd just see a smile come across their face for a second, and then they'd move on, you know?
Yeah, every search and rescue dog handler, and I've talked to many now, I've spoken with many now, and they've all said the same thing, that the first responders were actually comforted by the dogs. And, in fact, the term comfort dog, I might even be able to take responsibility for, because on the pier that the families would go to, there were dogs that just showed up, owned dogs in New York City. People just came out with their dogs, and I called them comfort dogs. I don't know that all the dogs were, quote, qualified to do it, but out of that event came the term that we now call comfort dogs.
All they needed to do was wag their tail.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Sure is.
Yeah. Chris Selfridge, thank you so much for your service. And, of course, Riley is now long gone, I presume. Correct?
Correct. He's, 11 and a half years he's been gone.
Yeah, yeah. But it's amazing how we remember. It's amazing the service that one dog provided, you know, in his lifetime. Thank you so very much, Chris.
Thank you, Steve. Really appreciate the time.
Next week, I have some personal memories regarding 9/11 and WGN and how this radio station was actually the first radio station to do something that I'll talk about next week, having to do with one particular search and rescue dog and having to do with the search and rescue dogs in general. It would be laughable if it wasn't so sad and, in my view, frankly, so ignorant. Some people who won't take the vaccine to protect against the sudden acute respiratory syndrome 2 causing COVID-19 are instead ingesting ivermectin. What's that? It's an antiparasitic used sometimes as a part of human medications, I know. A part of human medications, but greatly, it's an antiparasitic used in animals. And taking large doses meant for cattle or horses. Now, why they're doing this? They say it'll protect them against COVID-19. They say that presumably because early on in the pandemic, there was an Australian study. In that study, they looked on a slide about the effectiveness of ivermectin, which did impact the cellular structure of the spike protein that we've all heard about having to do with COVID-19. It made a difference on a slide. But since then, studies have been done. In fact, here, this is from the American Medical Association. In this randomized clinical trial that included 476 patients, the duration of symptoms was not significantly different for patients who received a 5-day course of ivermectin compared with a placebo. That was from a peer-reviewed study that was published in the American Medical Association Journal. I'll tell you, it's unfortunate, but I'm grateful the FDA has come out with a statement because it may save lives, but people are landing in the hospital because they're doing this. Crazy is crazy. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, right here, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN.